Well, thanks very much to Rolf for his talk, because I'm going to be moving more theoretic direction from what he did. I mean, where we've had yesterday was very practical, and there's a lot of real life stuff involved. Rolf described more, the last speaker yesterday and today's talk was more along the lines of how does one approach a data set statistically. And what I'm looking at today is more the theoretical aspects of what is the behavior of particular tools, statistical tools. To what extent can you trust them? And to what extent can you use them on a particular data set? So I have to get rid of that thing. So the idea, I talk about modeling distances between ignitions, but from my point of view, this is a problem where you have a point process of fire ignition points, let's say created by lightning, and you want to look at various tools for analyzing particular parts of that that kind of data, and what can we say about the performance of those tools. So as a motivating data set, I have a data set of ignitions we'll talk about shortly, and want to say, okay, if I want to characterize a certain aspect of the behavior of this data set, in this case interpoint distances, and sort of say, well, is there a power law behavior for those things, how would I go about estimating it? What sort of estimators and their properties can I derive? And in order to talk about the limiting behavior, so I have to get something that is analogous to the central limit theorem, but for this particular kind of estimators. And then, just for fun, look to see how well it works on this data set that I hunted up. So I must admit, this is my first time looking at forest fire stuff, so I don't have collaborators or anybody in particular to speak with, so I just go hunting on the internet, and I found a data set at this location, which describes large fires of at least 200 hectares. I'm old enough that I have no idea how big a hectare is. I remember acres, but you know, I don't know, somehow the transition to metric worked for liters and kilograms, but for hectares, it never made the transition for me. So anyway, this is a data set that I have, and as Rolf said, this data set has a lot of different features in it. I'm just basically going to extract longitude, latitude, and detection date. Of course, here I must remark that this is a plagiarized image. I tell my daughter it is not allowed to plagiarize from the web, but I can't, you know, time pressures, etc. Yeah, as opposed to R, I'm not a good programmer. I use SAS. So I just plot the locations of these things from the years 59 to 99. You can clearly see there's regional variation in the point process of ignitions. And, of course, there's time variation. Here's my little simulation from I can just bounce up and down between two pages. That's my MPEG attempt, physical MPEG. Now, I mean, this is the idea of how to analyze this sort of data. There's a variety of different approaches that arise from different contexts. Point processes arise in the numerous fields. One can certainly talk about to what degree it is Poisson. Is it clustered? Is it homogeneous? Is it what's called a solid core model, and various other types of things. You can track it perhaps by estimating the intensity measure, introducing exogenous variables. There's also a large literature on integrate and fire models and neural point processes, which could be adapted to this context. And the sort of thing that I want to look at here are interpoint distances, which is basically looking as the K function, we'll see it again today, looking at how what sort of spatial structure there is. It sort of measures the degree of attraction or separation between these sort of things. But in particular, there is a literature on interpoint distances in physics, and the idea is that, I'm going to say, just for simplicity, that I'm going to work in the plane for the time being. The actual fire data set later on is spatiotemporal, so it's working in three dimensions, but for pictures, it's easier to work with two. And so all of my observations consist of a pair xk1, xk2, and I can define an interpoint distance between two observations, xi and xj, by a function h of xi, xj. And If you wish to take Euclidean distance, that's fine, but in other applications, different kinds of distances may be better, more appropriate. Everything I talked about here works for a number of different definitions of distance, as long as they have a certain tail decay property. So the critical thing here is that we assume that the xk, the actual points, are independent, identically distributed, random vectors. So as we said before, we sort of distribute them at random on this plane. And I make here the critical assumption that the probability that the distance between x1 and x2 is less than or equal to x, this is asymptotically like, this is a mathematical term, slowly varying function in x, but critically the thing that we're interested in here is x to the power alpha. So there's this tail decay in the probability of finding points close together. So in terms of a picture, if I have 4 points scattered on the plane here, of course, h of x1, x2 is the distance between the first and the second point. And in a collection of 4 points, you have 6 possible pairs, and you can figure out the distance between any pair. Now we want to talk about, well, how do I estimate the probability that h of x1, x2 is less than or equal to something? Well, this is, you know, if you had a bunch of just a collection of independent data points, you say, well, I want to estimate the probability that x is less than or equal to 5, you'd count up the number that are less than 5, divide by the total number, that would give you an estimate. But in this context, you really don't have, you should proceed in that fashion, because fundamentally these h of x, I, x, j are not independent, right? This is h of x1, x2, x1, x3, 4, x1, x3, so they're all tied, those three values are all tied by the point x1, so that there are dependent variables. However, there is an approach to trying to estimate this sort of tail decay rate. You can get the empirical distribution function for the h of x1, x2. You take the log, and it decomposes as a constant plus alpha log x. So there's an idea that you could try to plot this versus log x and fit a linear regression, sort of like this. Here are the 6 distances, and you plot a linear regression, and you hope that the slope of that line is an estimate of that alpha index that you're looking for. I guess I should have said, why are you interested in that alpha index? Well, if the alpha is small, it means that the actual data structure has a much lower dimensional behavior than if alpha is large. And so although you may be working in a 12-dimensional space, if the alpha is 2, this means that effectively, locally, this thing is behaving like a 2-dimensional thing, something like that. So as I say here, this sort of technique doesn't look too impressive on a 4-point data set, but if you take a simulation of, in this case, 100 data points, plot the h of x1, xi, xj's cumulative function versus log x here, and fit a straight line, it gets better, but in fact, as we're interested only in what's happening in the lower tail, the usual thing you want to do is discard everything beyond a certain threshold and just fit the straight line to the points which are close to zero. So this seems to work fairly nicely for that simulation, but then again, another simulation indicates that, okay, well, it doesn't look so convincing any longer. So one may ask, can we say anything about how reliable this sort of a process is for estimating the index alpha that is of interest to us? And simulating IID points, computing all the interpoint distances, this is the empirical distribution function, if you wish, of those interpoint distances. And and in this case, we're just taking the lower tail of that group. Okay, so these sorts of things are not unheard of before. They've been examined for a variety of different applications. And in order to get some handle on the the asymptotics of various estimators, we need some idea of how do these extreme low values of the h of xi, xj behave. As I said before, the fundamental problem is that you have dependent observations. They're no longer h of x1, x6 is dependent, or has a dependence with h of x1, x5. So you no longer can just simply apply the standard theory for independent variables and obtain some sort of behavior of estimates. So one can look at trying to create some sort of a limit theorem for minimal interpoint distances. And again, we take this what's called a kernel, Euclidean distance, if you wish. We assume, as I did before, that you have a regular variation condition, that there's a tail decay of this rate. But in order to make things work, we're going to need an additional condition, which says here n cubed times probability that, oh, forget the an, that this is small and that is small goes to zero. And you can see here that there is an x1 in the first position of h in both cases, and then you have x2 and x3. This is an anti-clustering condition. And it's not really a condition on the xi's, because the xi's are independent. This is a condition on the type of function h that is permitted in this theorem. An example of something that would not work here is if you took h of x1, x3 to be the maximum of x1 and x3. Okay. That sort of a function would fail this condition, and you would not get the appropriate limit. On the other hand, if you take something like Euclidean distance, it will work because it has nice properties, smoothness properties. Okay, so for the mathematicians in the audience, this part is probably going to be of more interest than the people who are on the forest fire side. However, the technique of proof for this is to use another kind of point process. And I sort of like this because we're talking about point processes of forest fires, and the technique of proof for this type of limit theorem involves Poisson point processes, although of a different character. We define a point process NN, defined on, well, we'll see a picture in a minute, but it counts the number of points H of XI, XJ, which fall in certain blocks. So the idea is that if I have the ith and jth observation out of a group of n, I create my three-dimensional space here where the first coordinate is I over n, second coordinate is j over n. So these are bookkeeping coordinates that tell me which observations were contributing to this point, xi and xj. And then the height of this point is exactly the h of xi, xj, normalized by an appropriate scaling constant. So just that was for sort of telling you how to do it. If I do it for a bunch of uniform random variables on the unit interval, and I compute the interpoint distances, and I just look at those points which fall below a certain threshold, this is the sort of a picture that is being generated by this process. And I'm going to compress the, I'm going to look at it edgewise so that the I over n, j over n plane is along here, and the vertical axis represents the height of the point. So here is my point, again, this is the point I over n, j over n, a n, h. So the height here represents the interpoint distance. What kind of a limit theorem am I going to be obtaining here? Well, I'm going to get what's called a Poisson point process limit. That means if I take a particular box, A, in this space, and in this case, you can see the point process, number of points in that box is 2. So the point process evaluated the box is 2. Then as n goes to infinity, what should happen is that for a point process limit is that the number of points falling in that box converges in distribution to a Poisson random variable with a certain intensity evaluated at, which is given by the size of the box. And you have the other sort of point process properties that if you take disjoint boxes, then these two behave independently and things like that. So the idea, the fundamental tool mathematically that drives the theorems is that this object for every n, as you let n go to infinity, actually does converge to a Poisson limit and that I can identify what that limit is. Okay, so again, the tail variation condition. This theorem basically just says, okay, this empirical point process defined by the interpoint distances converges in distribution to a limiting Poisson point process, and you can actually compute its density over here. Now the key thing about, so you can see that the parameter alpha returns in the definition of the intensity, so that the limit process actually has the parameter alpha in it, so that we can now use it in some sense to characterize what is the behavior of the test statistics which are trying to estimate this alpha. So the other thing that one would want to note from this is that this is the qualitatively what this says is that as n goes to infinity, as the number, as the sample size goes to infinity, you have that these dependent interpoint distances behave as if they were generated from an independent Poisson process independently. So the condition that I wrote down before that said, oh, this anti-clustering condition that said, okay, H can't be of certain forms, but if H is of certain other type of things, everything will work, guarantees that in the limit, you can pretend that as if all of the interpoint distances were, in fact, independently drawn from a single distribution. Okay. So there are, as I want to come back to the problem of how to estimate this tail index alpha, and there are actually several point estimates that arise from several contexts. There's Taken's estimator for the correlation dimension. This comes from dynamical systems, where you're looking at a dynamical system that is evolving in some phase space, and you want to know to what degree is sort of fractal. You have the spatial K function, and you can build an estimator, but not using the entire K function that Rolf described, but only the part that's very close to zero. Okay. And then there is another one, which is for a tail estimator for extreme value observations, called a Hill estimator. And as opposed to using simulations to study the performance of these estimators, we can now employ this limit theorem in order to say something about what is the asymptotic behavior of these things, which ones are good, which ones are bad. And just to run through these estimators, there's, as I said, there's this idea of estimating dimension for dynamical systems. There's the Grassberger Procaccio estimator, and Taken's introduced one, which was motivated by the maximum likelihood principle in statistics. He made the assumption that the tail behavior was exactly x to the alpha, and then by going through the maximum likelihood machinery, came up with an estimator of this form. It looks ugly, but basically here you have log, for a given value delta, you count, you look at the log of the separations, you count, and you count up those interpoint distances that fall behind below a certain threshold, and you divide by the total number. Okay. And then you take the inverse. Now, in order to get limit results for this, if you fix the delta, then the number of points goes to infinity, and you get a biased estimate. So you have to let the window shrink to zero at a certain rate, and here we can identify that the rate, what the rate actually has to be in order to get a asymptotic limit. And so in particular, by playing using the asymptotic representation, we can obtain that this modified Taken's estimator has alpha T inverse, so it's estimating 1 over alpha instead of alpha, has asymptotic expectation 1 over alpha, but variance alpha 1 over alpha squared times this expression, which asymptotically is just alpha, like alpha 1 over alpha squared times a constant. The important thing here is to note that it does not shrink to zero, so that if you're using this estimator, you're never going to expect that there's actually convergence to some limit, like a convergence in probability to a limit. This is convergence in distribution to a something which has a distribution. Similarly, we can look at this k function, which in terms of the notation that I've used here can be looked at as a counting process, counting up how many observations fall below certain thresholds. So you can define this spatial k function as Rolf did. And if I look at the behavior of this k function, again, only near zero, not over the entire picture as he had, but only near zero, in smaller and smaller neighborhoods of zero, one can establish that there is weak convergence to an appropriate Poisson-type limit, or like this. And I'm running over a lot of technical details, so trying to find the balance between the two major groups in here, and probably missing both of them. But anyway. But once one has this distributional convergence, continuous mapping theorem and standard tools will allow you to establish estimates. So here, for example, one can use the continuous mapping theorem and just the least squares principle to establish that the sum of squared deviations between the log of the k function and a linear fit converges to an appropriate limit. The only thing that we have to introduce here is that the boundaries of these integrals cannot be zero and infinity. They actually have to be away from zero and away, separated from zero. And again, another continuous mapping theorem application shows that this minimizer of the least squares for the sample process will converge to something which is defined in terms of the limit process. And you can compute there in that case, for example, that this limiting object has got the right form, in a sense. There's an alpha, but then there's this expression that depends on alpha, the k function. Everything depends on the k function, but in particular the delta 0 and the delta 1, so that for any fixed choice of delta 0 and delta 1, you have a biased estimator. Okay, so if you're trying to estimate this tail decay index using the k function, it has some nice properties, but it also has this property that it's going to produce a biased estimator. And here, Hill estimate, using a Hill estimator for alpha, if you take your interpoint distances and sort them from smallest to largest, so as order statistics, then the classical estimator of tail decay for order using order statistics is this expression, which is the Hill estimator, and it's effectively like a geometric average of these ratios. Okay. And of course, again, using the theorem that I indicated before on asymptotic behavior, if the number of points m here goes to infinity, but not too quickly, then this is a consistent estimator. That is to say that this estimator of alpha will in fact converge to the limit, to the object you're trying to estimate. Okay. So you can see, these sort of results indicate sort of qualitative properties of these different estimators under different conditions. So we have three competing estimators. We have the Taakens estimator, which we saw asymptotically unbiased, alpha inverse is unbiased. We have the spatial k function near zero, and then the Hill estimator expression. Okay, so now we can see how well, just for exploratory sake, and I don't pretend that what I'm going to talk about from this point on has any practical relevance at all. Because I just hunted up this data set on the internet and decided to play with it. I think my greatest thing that I've learned is how to actually embed images into a LaTeX file. So I keep the longitude, the latitude, and the detection date. So here I'm really treating it as a spatial temporal process. Each observation is a point in space time, and three dimensional. Okay. And, of course, I'm making in order to apply this process, I've got to make some unrealistic assumptions. The space-time data and ignitions are independent, identically distributed observations from a single density. This is ridiculous. It does not hold at all. However, we'll go forward with that. Also, in defining a distance, which would be given by plain Euclidean distance, you know, the difference in longitude, the difference in latitude. And here I take the time, since it's given in effectively years, years decimal times some decimal years. I don't know what sort of notation that was, but anyway, multiply it by 1,000. Too. Of course, you know, that's completely arbitrary choice. Now, however, it is clear, as Rolf said, that if we start trying to apply these methods, if I'm trying to estimate this tail index behavior, any of those methods that I showed before are going to be based on relatively few, in fact, very few, comparatively speaking, interpoint distances, the least interpoint distances. So the most intense areas are going to govern the estimate of alpha. The bulk of your data is irrelevant. This is the area only where you have the highest concentration of fires. And these are all lightning-started fires. Also, when I looked at this data set, there were a lot of interpoint distances of zero, which, of course, since I don't have access to the people who created the data set, I cannot obtain either better, more precise measurements or to decide whether these were duplicate entries or what happens. These are apparently fires that occur in the same spot at the same time, twice or more. Okay. And also when we're playing with this thing, although it may not have been obvious when we were looking at the theoretical development, it turns out that the Tawkins and Hill estimators, if I give you exactly the same number of extremes to work with, provide exactly the same values. So numerically, they turn out to be the same. The difference between the two is that the Tawkins estimator says there's a certain window and collects all the points that fall inside the window, and the Hill estimator says, well, my window, I don't care about a window, I'm going to take a fixed number of points. So they're very close to each other, and if they have exactly the same number of points that fall in the window as in the Hill's estimator, you get back exactly the same estimate. So in fact, we can take the properties that we derived for the Hill estimator and those for the Tawkins estimator and combine them. Okay, so if I take this particular data set, I plot the least interpoint distances against the what I call index here. We can obtain that the Tawkins estimator is with delta equal to 0.03, is 1.9. K function estimate is 1.5. Hill estimate is about 2.1. Some people might delete this point, saying, "Well, it looks a little bit weird." Those are your revised estimates if you want to do that, but generally speaking, there's no particular reason to delete them. But we might look at that and say, well, for this data set, it seems that we have a tail decay of approximately 2. Does that seem reasonable? Well, I do have the asymptotic behavior of the Tawkins estimator, and it does have a mean and a variance. I could try to create some sort of a confidence interval based upon simple calculations from that fact. And if I apply it to this case, what I get is that I can get a lower confidence limit, approximately, let's say a 2-standard-deviation confidence limit, which turns out to be about 0.63. But the upper limit on the confidence interval would be infinity. So there's no, it's not too exciting. I could also try now to use simulations, perhaps, to understand what the result of my analysis is like for this particular data set. If I take a 3-dimensional standard normal and compute these estimators 5 times, and you see that the values are around 3, and in fact, standard normals are very nice to work with because I can actually theoretically obtain the exact value of alpha. It's got to be 3. So you can see that in these simulations, at least, these values are, you know, in the neighborhood of 3. They don't seem to be too close to 2, so maybe I try 2. If I simulate a bunch of 2-dimensional normals where I know that the alpha has to be exactly 2, you can see that the values are, well, just a little bit higher than 2. So it is plausible, at least in this data set, that the this alpha, which I'm using for the interpoint distance decay rate, is strictly less than 3. So that means that there is some sort of spatiotemporal structure to the behavior of points. Similar as to what Rolf said, I mean, there seems to be some degree of cohesion among the placement of these things. This sort of approach doesn't tell you that the data points are in fact got to be that way, and in fact here there's lots of, again, one would want to have all of the exogenous variables and such as vegetation and weather and so forth built into this before one made any sort of a conclusion. However, there does seem to be evidence for this sort of lower dimensional behavior. All right. However, just as Rolf did, and you know, we did not collaborate on this before we spoke, this data set, in fact, is data over multiple years. And there's no, I mean, to this point, I had just entered this as being a sample from a single density spread over time and space. But it's quite reasonable to take the, you know, you look at the plot of forest fires versus time, and you can see, of course, that this is the summertime and that's the winter time, and there's maybe reasonable expectation that what's happening here could be treated as an independent sample from what's happening there. So this data set, take the data from 1980 to 1999, we have 20 observations of this kind, compute the tail index for each one of these data groups separately, and then see what happens. So here's the plot from 1980 to 2000, and the black is the Taakens estimator, and the red is the K-function estimator. So they track each other fairly well, and you can see that the values are in this range, except perhaps with one excursion. So since these are independent samples, we can now treat them as, you know, take averages and so forth, and just for the hell of it, let's compute the standard T interval based upon these 20 observations. We have that the average across the 20 is 1.57 with a confidence interval 1.34 to 1.79. So I think this is reasonable evidence that there is some sort of lower dimensional structure here. That there, you know, this sort of confidence interval now more strongly states that the alpha is not 3. I mean, the previous thing I had was 0.63 to infinity, so of course 3 was possible. And since we're talking about three-dimensional observations, in any case, what you want to know, is it behaving completely randomly as if it was just a IID observations for, into some sort of three-dimensional box? Or is it behaving as a lower-dimensional object? Now, this is something along those lines. If we're able to treat these successive years as independent realizations of an experiment and to combine the estimates that we get from each one into a confidence interval, we do seem to have, by this sort of a process, an indication that there is something there, that it's not entirely just a fluke. And finally, I'd just like to say thank you to the organizers. I hope that I've found the middle ground between the theoreticians and the practitioners. Either both people were able to take something away from this, or neither group got anything. This was a variant on the Stein-Chan method. Okay, so it's it works for independent XIs, and our goal was to extend it somehow to dynamical, to actually make it applicable to things that are more that like dynamical systems where the XIs are in fact dependent. But of course, the Stein-Chan method is completely useless for that. It still didn't help. I mean, when you're talking about these extreme value results, you're talking about events which are very, very thin, and the mixing results don't help you very much with that. We haven't had any success. Yeah. But if there's a gradual trend like that, fitting a linear fit to those points would be perfectly acceptable. Yeah, we could, and then you could do a test for that. So that wouldn't be a problem, but there would be a problem if it was cycling in some way. I think that would be a bigger problem. Yeah. Good.
Yep. Yeah, you kind of could usually use K function.
Mm-hmm.
But we did the, you know, by video inspection, which section we should take.
Yeah.
So you use delta 0 and delta 1, but can you explain a bit more, you know, how we make define?
I think that particular problem, if you have a K function and you have those two limits that you have to use in order to define what interval that you want to use for the estimation process, it's a classic kernel estimation problem where you have to balance off bias against variance. If you take too many, too large a thing, you will be biasing your data because it's not the actual rate at near the origin. But if you take it decreasing to zero too quickly, then of course then you lose all hope of getting anything that is stable in any sense. However, what these particular results here show, at least, is that, I mean, for one can say is a qualitative thing, that if you're using a method that is using only a fixed number of extremes, you cannot expect to get a convergence in probability of this estimator, because there's just too much variation that's left over. And it's only the last one that I showed up where we had the Hill estimator. It was the Hill estimator, and it got this consistency result that, okay, things can go will converge in probability to the appropriate constant. But there you had to assume that the number of points is increasing to infinity at slower than root n the rate. And in practice, of course, you cannot figure this out. You can't write this down. I mean, it's a theoretic result that says if you let the envelope grow slowly enough, it will work. So if you take, you know, the neighborhoods of zero increasing slowly enough, you will get an asymptotically consistent estimator. But for a fixed number, it's always going to have a distributional limit, a weak limit, in our language. Yes.